What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Jonina Abram Irvin. Jonina is a journalist and has been a Black community organizer for over 50 years. She was a member of the Black Panther Party for nearly a decade and was the final editor of the Black Panther newspaper. A retired journalism professor, Jonina was the former managing editor of Black Scholar magazine. She is the author of the just-released book, Driven by the Movement, Reports from the Black Power Era, which we are in discussion about today. Jonina, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I would actually like to start, if you don't mind, by spending some time talking about you and your history. My understanding, you were born in Detroit. What was growing up like? What was your family like?
Actually, I joined the Black Panther Party in Detroit. I was actually born in Morristown, Tennessee. My late father was a United Methodist minister. My mother was a music teacher. I spent my childhood, I actually grew up in Jefferson City, Missouri, which is the capital city of Missouri. In 1956, when I was 8 years old, I was among the first Black kids to integrate the public schools there after Brown versus the Board of Education was passed. You know, it was something that I didn't understand what it was at the time. I just knew from my parents that it was a big deal for me to be going to school with white kids, having gone to a segregated school prior to that. So I spent my childhood in Jefferson City, which is at that time was about 30,000 people. So that's kind of in a nutshell, my childhood. I later, after I graduated from high school, I went to college, church college in Kansas, because my father was a minister. I got a discount at the college. And, you know, I started college in 1966 when I was 18 years old. I started a month before the Black Panther Party actually was created, because it was created in October of 1966. And I didn't really know anything about the Black Panther Party until several months later, when I was finishing up my freshman year in college, and I was watching the news one evening, and I saw these young Black people who had marched into the California State Legislature in Sacramento, California, and they were protesting this new bill they were going to be to pass that would prevent people from carrying loaded weapons in public. Up until that time, it was legal up until 1966 for people in California to carry a loaded weapon, in California. But of course, when the Black Panther Party came on the scene and was doing community patrols of the police, the elected officials, politicians, they didn't like that. So they had this legislation proposed to end the ability to walk around with guns. And of course, I hadn't really heard anything about the Black Panther Party until I saw this newscast. So I'm gonna be honest, I'm always honest with people about this. When I first saw this, I actually thought that the Black Panther Party was crazy. I said, how do Black people think that white people are gonna let them march into their state legislature armed with guns and, essentially kind of try to take over. So that was my initial reaction to the Black Panther Party. However, we'll talk about that more later. I did change my opinions.
Talk to me about heading to Detroit. Why did you head to Detroit? How did that become the city wherein you joined the party?
My ex-husband, he's from Detroit, so we joined the Black Panther Party in Detroit. That's how I wound up being there, specifically in Detroit. We weren't there very long because this is around the time when the party's leadership made the decision to close all the local chapters of the Black Panther Party around the country and have them come to Oakland, which is where the Black Panther Party was created. And they wanted to make Oakland a base of operations to, you know, really begin to develop the party's program and platform. So we were in Detroit, you know, I joined there in summer of 1972. And then in early March, April of 1974, we actually, it was about half a dozen of us. We, got on the road, took all of our worldly possessions that we had, and we moved to Oakland. So that's how I got to Detroit originally. While in Detroit, I did among the work that I did in the Black Panther Party there was to sell the Black Panther newspaper. Some people may not realize it, but in the late 1960s, early 1970s, the Black Panther Party newspaper had the highest circulation, second highest circulation of any Black newspaper in the United States, except for Muhammad Speaks, which is a newspaper of the Nation of Islam. The Black Panther Party had the second highest circulation of Black newspapers. So I'll never forget being in downtown Detroit, and we'd be on the Black Panthers. We'd be on one corner selling the Black Panther newspaper, and on the other corner would be folks from the Nation of Islam selling Muhammad Speaks. So that was one of the things that I did. I worked in the party's free breakfast program for children. Most people have heard of how the Black Panther Party did have a breakfast program. We would give kids good, hot, nourishing breakfast, during the regular school months of the year. And I worked in that program. And I also helped with the Black Panther Party's free busing to prisons program. Now, we didn't actually have a bus in Detroit. We used cars. But the Black Panther Party had started a program in which they provided free transportation to people to go to visit their relatives or friends who were locked up in, prisons around the country. This was a very important program because for a lot of the prisoners, if you didn't have a chance to see your family, just made being locked up that much harder. So we did have this, what we call the free busing to prisons program. In Detroit, like I said, we didn't have a bus, we had cars. And at the time, for whatever reason, I can't remember, not very many of the brothers who were in the Detroit chapter had their driver's licenses. And so I was somebody who did have a driver's license. So I would drive folks up from Detroit to a Jackson State Prison in Jackson, Michigan, which at that time in the early 70s was the largest prison in the United States in terms of how many people we had incarcerated. Now, that's not true anymore. And in fact, Jackson State Prison has been broken down into several prisons. But at that time, it was the largest in the United States in terms of state prisons with a number of people who were locked up and incarcerated. And, I had never been inside a prison or a jail until I, was a driver for the Free Busing to Prisons program. And it was really overwhelming. There were so many people locked up in this prison. Completely overwhelmed me. But I was a Black Panther and I had to keep my cool. But, later when I got back to Detroit, I'm gonna be honest, I had a good cry. I cried about it. I couldn't cry while I was there, but I cried about it. I never had, I had seen what had happened with the Attica Rebellion, and that was what really began to educate me about, prisons in this country, but I had never been in one myself. So driving in the busing to prisons program was really very educational for me. It helped me to understand a lot about what was going on inside the prisons.
Thank you for that, Jonina. Jonina, you mentioned that when you first heard of the party and when they marched into the state's capital to protest the Mumford Act, that you thought that they were not quite right. What shifted for you? Like, how did you go from thinking that these brothers, I think how you say in the book is that they're going to get themselves killed and innocent bystanders or the folks around them killed, to, yes, I'm going to join this organization? What was the turning point for you?
Well, as time went on, I began to learn more about the Black Panther Party. You know, there's survival programs like the free food program and the breakfast program. And I also, the Black Power movement was at its peak during this time. I wanted to be in the Black Power movement. I had committed myself to doing that. And I realized that as an individual by myself, there was only a limited amount that I could do. But I began to look at what the Black Panther Party was doing with their survival programs. And I thought, you know, Black people working together in something like this, we can begin, you know, to make a difference. We can begin to change things in this country. And I also had began to hear about the fact that the Black Panther Party, a lot of people don't know, but the Black Panther Party was the first organization to offer free nationwide testing for sickle cell anemia, which is a disease that primarily affects people of color, people of African descent, other people of color, a blood disease that can kill people. And the federal government was totally ignoring it, wasn't doing anything about it. The Black Panther Party, you know, criticized the feds for not doing anything. And so they began free nationwide testing for sickle cell anemia and also for high blood pressure. The Black Panther Party did free testing for high blood pressure, which is a disease that affects a lot of Black people, a lot of people who are, you know, in poverty. I didn't have it back then because I was only 24, 25 years old, but I now have high blood pressure, so I understand the significance of what the Black Panther Party did. They were doing work that was relating to people's everyday survival. A lot of people don't know that back then, everybody in the Black community at that time when the Black Panther Party got started did not agree with the Black Panther Party about community patrols of the police, did not agree about armed self-defense. The Black community was not unified on that issue by any means, and some people did not like the Black Panther Party because of that. But when the Black Panther Party began their survival programs, began to feed, you know, kids breakfast, began the free food programs, began sickle cell anemia programs, and also we had health clinics, began to bus people to prisons to visit their family ones who are locked up. That's when the Black Panther Party actually began to get more support in the community, because it was relating to people's everyday material needs, the kind of things that keep people, you know, going from day to day. So I began to see that I could relate more to that. And that is why, you know, I decided to join.
For you, who've been a lifelong organizer, what lessons did you take from your time, 10 years, I believe, with the party, for better or for worse, that have shaped how you move through the world as a Black revolutionary organizer woman in the work?
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned and I've been able to keep with me all this time over 50 years later, is they taught me how to become a community organizer. That's how I learned. You know, you go, the Black Panther Party would, you know, talk to people, find out what people needed. That's how they started the various survival programs. One of the other survival programs they had was pest control program. The Black Panther Party would go into people's houses or apartments and, you know, help them get rid of rats and roaches. And, you know, I learned the skills that I needed to learn to be able to talk to people, to find out what their needs were. You have to talk to people about what they need. You may think they need something, but you have to talk to them about what they think they need, what is most important. So I learned to become an organizer. The skills that were needed, and that's something I will always be grateful to the Black Panther Party for, that skills I've been able to keep with me all these years later, skills that I used, in 1999 and 2000, when I was living in a town called Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's in southwest Michigan. It's midway between Detroit and Chicago. And I was teaching journalism at a university there. And it was revealed, locked up and put in county jail there, were being stripped naked of their clothes, or they were being stripped down to their underwear. You know, that story made the front page of the newspaper there, and people were outraged about it. Ultimately, with encouragement from people, I helped to start an organization that fought the naked jailings there. It was called the Southwest Michigan Coalition Against Racism and Police Brutality. And we waged a 3-year campaign, which I'm not going to say we stopped police brutality totally. That would be naive, but we did stop the naked jailing of Black men. That is something that we did too. Well, if I hadn't had training in the Black Panther Party and watched the Black Panther Party organize against police brutality, I might not have been able to do that. But I still had those skills, and I was still able to do it. Even though I hadn't done it for a long time, and I had a lot of doubts about it. But my current husband now, who was also a former member of the Black Panther Party, he joined in Atlanta when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Black Panther Party had a brief merger. But he told me, he said, "You were in the Black Panther Party, you know how to do this." And I didn't think that I still did, but I did, and I was able to do it. That's one thing the Black Panther Party taught me, was how to be an organizer. The other thing is, working on the Black Panther newspaper, we would carry articles about what was going on around the world to poor and oppressed people, whether they were in Africa, South America, Asia, wherever they were. We would carry articles about what was going on with their oppression. And, I had to do a lot of reading, to read about that. And I may have written articles about it. And sometimes I did write articles about it for the Black Panther newspaper. And that helped me understand. It really contributed to my education about what was going on in the world. A lot of times we get focused on the United States, what's happening to people, oppressed people in the United States. But, the Black Panther people regularly carried columns about what was happening. We called it People's Perspective. And we talked about what was going on with the oppressed people in other parts of the world. And that's how I became more educated about what was going on, and understanding that I had to get beyond what was going on in the United States. Yes, that was my primary responsibility, because I was, because I'm an American of African descent. So my first struggle was here. Well, where I was born, but I also had to understand what was going on around the world. And of course, the Black Panther Party was concerned about what was going on around the world with oppressed people. So it really, really contributed to my education and my knowledge. To this very day, I was having a conversation once with a sister I was in the Black Panther Party with, and she said, "Man," she said, "sometimes I wish I didn't really understand all the stuff that's going on in the world." She said, "But I do understand it because I was in the party, and the party taught us how to understand it." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." And that's how come, we do have that knowledge. And I feel blessed I'm not saying that I'm an expert on everything that's going on around the world. I'm not an expert. But a lot of the stuff I do have a different perspective on, and I do understand to the depth that I do because I was in the Black Panther Party. And I will always, be grateful to the party for that, for giving me that knowledge.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Jonana Abram Irvin about her book, Driven by the Movement, Reports from the Black Power Era. Jonana, people often romanticize the Black Panther Party, and you actually talk about this a little bit in your book, and try to recreate some version of it, right? But they often try to recreate it as it was, rather than building something out of the current political conditions. Because the political conditions now are not the political conditions that existed in 1966. What would you say to those folks?
I would say just what you said and more. I would say that the conditions do not exist now that existed then. There's never, ever going to be a Black Panther Party like it was back then, because we can never go back to 1966. People do have to deal with the current situation. You know, that's part of the romanticizing of the Black Panther Party and other movements that happened back then. There's too much romanticism. I understand that people respect what we did back then, and I'm glad that they respected what we did. But we're in a period right now in which we're facing a fascist state in the United States of America, and we have to talk about the conditions now that we have to deal with. Police terror in the United States is far worse than it was back in 1966. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale did, and the comrades did community patrols of the police, but it's far worse. Well over 1,000 people were killed just last year by police in the United States. The police are militarized like they were not militarized back in the 60s. So organizers today have to deal with that reality, the militarization of the police. And in many ways, what's happening now with the level of police terror we have is in fact a form of lynching. It's 21st century lynching. People may not be, you know, necessarily hanging by their necks from trees, but this rampant police murder by law enforcement of Black people and other people of color on the streets is a form of lynching. So people who are organizers today need to deal with that and face that reality. We also have to look at, you know, in terms of the world, in terms of things like homelessness. So many people in this country are houseless. Back in the day, back in the 60s, there were people who were houseless, but not to the degree that it is now. It's far worse. Younger people now who are they have a far worse situation in many ways to deal with than we had to deal with back in the day. But certainly the whole issue of people who are houseless is far worse. And a lot of this has to do with the level of poverty. Poverty among Black people and other people of color, and even among poor white people. Poverty is worse. We did have back in the day, we had a situation where there were still a lot of viable industrial jobs. A lot of the factories were still open that paid good money back then for people. But, you know, beginning in the late 70s and onward, a lot of the factories started to shut down. The corporations moved their companies overseas because they didn't have to pay workers as much money. So today's activists have to deal with the fact that the level of poverty is worse, and it has to be addressed in a different way than it was addressed back then, because it was worse. The conditions are worse. So what I would say to people is, do not romanticize what the Black Panther Party or any other group did back in the 1960s. Always remind yourself that the Black Panther Party was dealing with the concrete material, political, social conditions that faced people in late 20th century America, late 60s, early 70s. We are now in the 21st, early 21st century. It's a different time. I tell young people I talk to today, I said that you all live in a far different world than I lived in, you know, over half a century ago. It's much different. You can't recreate what we did. I wish we had back then. I wish we had had cell phones. I wish we'd had the internet. I wish we'd had, the ability to communicate like we do online and everything. We didn't have that. Like I said, it's a far different world. Young people today grew up on cell phones, you know, and it's just a way of life. They understand it. I didn't start using cell phones till 25 years ago. So, you know, I'm still in some ways a 20th century person trying to catch up with, you know, all the 21st century technology. But just remember that you have to deal with the concrete conditions of the present era. Do not romanticize. Do not go back to the past. You will fail. You try to build a movement on what will happen back in the 60s and 70s, you will fail because it's not relevant to what is going on now.
A couple of nights ago, I was at a meeting of Black organizers. You know, we're dealing with this moment that we're in right now. And someone brought up, as people often do, I mean, I live in Oakland, so people refer to the Black Panther Party all of the time, that the Panthers showed us the way in terms of what the fight is for with the 10-point platform. So not necessarily about how to get there, but what we're fighting for. And then they point out, you know, we haven't even achieved what's on that list. That list is a massive list of things, right? What parts of the 10-point do you agree that the 10-point platform is still a good roadmap for what we're fighting for, or what pieces of it need to be evolved and pulled into to addressing today's political conditions?
I definitely think that it is a good roadmap. Obviously, you know, much more has to be done. It has to be done on a more intense level. I think that it is a good roadmap. I think that the whole issue of the party talks about the whole issue of prisons. I think the mass imprisonment, a struggle against mass incarceration, has a lot of work to be done on it, because I don't think that certainly has not advanced to the level that it needs to advance to. So I think more work needs to be done on that. Obviously, you know, there more work needs to be done on all the different areas. The roadmap, it's a good roadmap, but people have to always look at that roadmap and say, okay, but what are we dealing with now in terms of police terror? What are we dealing with now in terms of mass incarceration? What are we dealing with now in terms of, poverty? And the public school system, you know, education. You have to look at it and say, okay, what pieces can we take that we can use today? And then what is not relevant to today? And what do we need to build on? What do we need to increase or do differently? That always has to be the case, always making it deal with the present time and making it relevant to that.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with Jonina Abram Irvin. We are discussing her book, Driven by the Movement, Reports from the Black Power Era. Jonina, we just have a few minutes left, and I want to give you an opportunity to bring up at least two, maybe three, we'll see how time goes, of the rank and file folks that you do uplift in your book. And I'd like to start with Joyce Grant of Boston.
Yes, Joyce Grant was born in the late 1930s in Boston. Her parents had immigrated to the United States from the Caribbean. She got her degree in education to be a teacher. She had some difficulties at first getting a job in Boston, because Boston, at least back then, maybe today, is highly segregated. But she ultimately got involved in an organization called the Mass Freedom Movement. And this was an organization that was sort of like straddled civil rights, black power, you know, kind of was like, it was like doing a little bit of both, because, understand the Black Power movement grew out of the Civil Rights Movement. And Joyce was a secretary for the Mass Freedom Movement in Boston. And she described it as a 9-to-5 thing, not a 9-to-5 thing. She didn't have much chance for a personal life. And, you know, she was working very hard in that work that she did. They did a lot of work around housing, public schools, the problems in the public schools, which, as I mentioned before, tended to be rather segregated. Later, after she became a principal an independent school, not part of the public school system, but an independent school in Boston, she became principal of that school. People were looking for alternative ways to educate their kids, and so she did do that, and she became principal of that school, and later she became a professor of education.
Thank you for that. I'm going to stick with the women here. What about Jacqueline or Jackie Pope?
Jacqueline Pope, Jackie Pope was another educator. Jackie was, at the time she began her work in the Black Power era, she was a single mother of four living, in Brooklyn, New York. And she was struggling to make ends meet, being a single parent. And she ran into some people who were involved in an organization that was called the National Welfare Rights Organization, or NWRO. And this was an organization that was primarily made up of Black women, and many of whom, they were all basically poor, but many of whom received welfare stipends from the government, and they were mistreated in terms of not getting all their rights, not getting all they were entitled to as welfare rights recipients. They would not get what white women would get. And the organization was formed. It was nationwide, but she belonged to it in Brooklyn, New York. And she ultimately became one of the spokespeople, organizers for it on the East Coast. She would go around. She talked about how one of the things that they had to do in terms of getting all they had to do to get their rights was they found out that welfare rights recipients were entitled to certain specific things. And when they found out that they weren't getting those things, that the white women who were welfare recipients were getting those things, they started raising hell with the people who were in charge of the welfare department. Hey, how come the white women get this stuff and we don't get it? We're entitled to get it too. We have the rights to do that. And, made the welfare rights recipients, Jackie, when she first started getting welfare, she was ashamed. She didn't really want anybody to know she was on welfare. But, being in that movement helped her to understand, that conditions of poverty bring people in a situation like that. And these women became very proud, very strong organizers, even though they were poor and they didn't have much. They started to speak out for their rights and demand that they be treated with respect.
Jonina, what is your hope for this book in the world?
Well, for one thing, I want people who read it, I especially want the young people who read it to see that it was everyday people in the community, in the Black community, who were part of the Black Power era, part of the Black Power movement. We hear a lot about the celebrities and people who became famous, and I'm not trying to take anything away from them, but the backbone of the Black Power era, the Black Power movement, were the everyday, ordinary people. And I want people to understand that, to know that, you don't have to be a special person with some kind of special knowledge or anything. It was everyday folks who volunteered to cook in the free breakfast program. Right now, in particular, with the efforts being made to censor a lot of books about Black history, that they don't want people to know about what went on back then. My hope is that as the people will keep on fighting the censorship, but that at least my book will help contribute some information and some knowledge to what did happen back there that young people may not be able to get, or future generations may not be able to get with all the censorship that is going on right now, that they will have this knowledge, that they will have this information.
Janina, thank you so much for joining us today.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.